Get ready for a journey into the heart of Bridgeport politics with In Absentia, a new podcast from Connecticut Public's investigative team, The Accountability Project. Learn about the city's past and present political dysfunction and the systems that enable it. Tune in wherever you get your podcasts.
Funding provided by Joe Zimmel and Valerie Friedman.
Hi, I'm Jane Whitney. Welcome to the Common Ground Podcast. On every episode, we bring together diverse voices from across the nation to discuss the most pressing and controversial issues of our time, issues that make a difference in your life. On September 12th, we spoke with leading women's rights activists about successes and setbacks in the ongoing battle for gender equality. Years ago, when I interviewed Ivana Trump, she was seen as a superwoman, a dynamo inside and outside the home. So I asked her, Ivana, you look like you have it all. You're a best-selling author, a successful businesswoman, a wife, and a mother. Ivana, can you have it all? And she replied, yes, you can, just not at the same time. Now, as COVID continues to decimate women's hard-won gains and derail the fight for gender equality, the question is, what can women have at all? Here to help answer that question, Katty Kay, executive producer of Aussie Media and former BBC correspondent, Sophia Nelson, scholar in residence at Christopher Newport University, Stacey Plaskett, delegate to the U.S. House of Representatives, and Cecile Richards, co-founder of Supermajority and former president of Planned Parenthood. And we're honored to have you with us. We're so excited about you being here. In a few minutes, we're going to focus on the firestorm that was set off by the Texas law that could foreshadow an end to the landmark ruling of Roe v. Wade. But first, I want to get all of your top lines on how women have been disproportionately hurt by this pandemic. And Cecile, I'm going to start with you. People have said that this pandemic has set women back a generation. Do you think that's too harsh?
Well, it's certainly true that women were disproportionately impacted, and particularly women who work in the service sector and healthcare and education, where women are disproportionately represented in the workforce. And yes, I think there are systemic problems in the United States that we've never addressed. The lack of affordable childcare, lack of paid family leave, things that other developed countries have had for a long time. And so those two things really did come crashing together. And we're seeing now women struggling to get back into the workforce, either because of the industries that they had to leave, or the fact that it's still very difficult to make sure that your children are safe going back to school, safe going back into childcare.
You wrote about this whole thing in Ms. Magazine when you talked about the gender inequities really were a pre-existing condition, and you just sort of touched on that. That really what's happened is the pandemic has exposed the reality that this system just isn't built for women. And that's, I think, why it's been particularly difficult. You mentioned childcare, but it seems so overwhelming. Where do you even start to try and make this right for women?
Well, I'm thrilled that Congresswoman Plaskett's on, because she'll be able to talk a little bit on the, she's on the front lines here of how government can make a difference. But that to me is what has to happen. As we all know, any of us who've raised kids, it's like you are kind of out there on your own trying to figure out constantly how to make sure your kids are taken care of so that you can work. And of course, fix dinner and all the things that women deal with. And the workforce wasn't built for us to take part. And I think a very good example is the child tax credit that went into effect in July and is going to continue through this year. And of course, some people are in Congress, Democrats in particular, are trying to make that permanent. This is something that actually gives cash money to most families in America to help take care of their kids, and recognizing that people with children have a disproportionate cost, particularly in this pandemic, when they've got to figure out how to make sure their kids are taken care of so that they can work. I think there are specific things we know how to do. And I would point out the efforts that are being made to fund affordable child care. I mean, it is really rough, as we know, to find affordable care. And it's been particularly difficult because it's been hard for the very women who provide that care to get back into the workforce. But I think there are very specific proposals. I've been very, thrilled, actually, that the Biden administration, I think with the encouragement of a lot of women around the country and women in Congress, have really put things that we've never particularly funded before in the forefront of both the Recovery Act and now, of course, in the infrastructure plan and the reconciliation budget. That, to me, is a good sign that women's voices are, and women literally are at the table now.
Stacey, I am going to turn to you at this point, because first I want to get your top lines. What do you hear? I know childcare, but let's say outside of childcare, what do you hear from women that they just need help to do?
Sure. I think that women are asking for equality at the end of the day and an equitable treatment by Congress to bring them in the same place as men. I'm a member of the Women's Caucus, the Democratic Women's Caucus, and we're fighting for H.R. 7, which was passed in the House, and we're asking the Senate to take it up. Which is a Paycheck Fairness Act, which hasn't been passed as yet. That's something that I think is crucially important for the amount of work that women do, that they are not paid equitably at this time. The other thing that people are also not even aware of is that many of these childcare facilities, these small childcare areas, are disproportionately run by women and run by minority women of color. So ensuring that they are able to take care of their workers as well. We've had instances where women are childcare providers, work in childcare facilities, and can't afford to pay for childcare for their own children. So those are the kinds of issues I think that women are at the table. And so women are going to be taking these issues up, along with the Violence Against Women Act, trying to get that passed once again, having it reauthorized. The last time that bill was taken up was in 2013, and asking once again to ensure that all of the things that, as you rightly put, Jane, the COVID pandemic has peeled back the cover on showing the inequities and showing gaps in our democracy and in our society that we're able to shore up. We're not a perfect union as yet, but with more women at the table, we're having the discussion to ensure that, one, we don't go backward, but we're also moving forward.
Kati, let me turn to you at this point, because back in April of 2020, you were being optimistic. I think you were looking for silver linings, potentially, during a very difficult time. And you were hopeful at that point that perhaps a pandemic would provide women with a bit more power in the workplace and at home. I think that's the quote that I remember. Has that worked for anybody?
The numbers suggest not, right? And not just here in the United States, but around the world, women have been disproportionately affected by COVID. And the real issue is childcare. But the difference between America and some other countries is that those countries that have a better social welfare net, the European Union countries, for example, you're starting to see women regaining the employment rates that they had prior to COVID. So there are policies around there in the world that could help women during this process. It's just that the United States doesn't have some of those policies. I think the thing that I was optimistic about, and I'm still hoping that in the long run, if we can get women back into the workforce and reverse some of these gains and critically get childcare sorted in this country, is that one of the things that women have asked for a very long time is a certain measure of control in terms of their working lives. I spent decades begging my employers to be able to work from home one day a week or leave early on, Wednesdays and Thursdays. And the response was always sort of begrudging. It was always, well, how do we know that you're actually going to do this? And my experience is by no means exceptional. This was the response that a lot of women will have got from employers, often male employers, when they said, you know what, I just need a little bit more control in order not to hit that brick wall of kids versus career. And I think that what we have shown in COVID, obviously, very quickly, is that the technology is there and we can be trusted. We can work and have some control over our whereabouts. Now, none of that works if you don't fix the childcare component of this, particularly for working mothers who, as the pandemic has shown, far more than working fathers took on the burden of extra childcare at home, which is another thing, by the way, that needs to be fixed. And I think we need to have a real conversation about why it is still that that burden shares, you know, falls disproportionately to women and not to men.
But you've raised the issue, really, which is the pandemic changed everything. It changed the way we work, the way we live, the way we love, the way we eat. And the expectations stayed the same for women and particularly for mothers. What is the commentary that we draw from that? Women are just supposed to soldier on and get it all done. And in fact, you mentioned that basically the load of childcare was picked up by women. It's almost like women had a second job, especially if they were home.
Which is what a lot of women were saying. And some women left the workforce because women are disproportionately employed in sectors that were hit by COVID, in the retail sectors and in the service industry. We know that. But some women left the workforce because they couldn't do it. They couldn't pick up all the childcare of children who were home full time and manage their jobs with a partner who was not pitching in 50-50. I mean, it's certainly true that, you know, the role for men, paradoxically, has almost changed less than it has for women. I mean, this notion of what it takes to be a man, which is to be focused on your job and be kind of alpha and not be doing childcare and not be doing household duties, it's incredibly stubborn, isn't it? I mean, it's been remarkably pernicious, that role model that society seems to have of men and men seem to have of themselves. And I think we really saw that. I mean, look, there are clearly very big structural issues that need to be fixed, particularly here in the United States, even more so than in the European Union, which has a better social welfare net, which has better childcare programs. But there's also something cultural going on, and I think COVID revealed that.
Sophia, you went back and did some research on how women were being affected financially, professionally, emotionally. And I want to ask you about the latter, emotional impact, because I think very often, especially since this has gone on for as long as it has, we underestimate how much impact this pandemic really has on us emotionally. We carry on, we soldier on, but it's omnipresent. So what did you learn in doing the research to update your book?
Well, a couple things. You know, first of all, we as women are socialized, particularly women over, I'd say, 45 years of age, Gen Xer women. And I believe we're the last generation of women probably to have this type of burden that we carry, that we were socialized as girls and as young women to keep going no matter what. Adding being a woman of color, and you're really taught in your culture to be always strong, always on, never to show people your vulnerabilities. And as women, as mothers, as wives, as daughters, during the pandemic, that stress got 10 times worse for us. And so women who were taking care of their children all of a sudden had their children home. They had their husbands home, kids from college home. Then they had to check in on their parents who were aging. And you talk about a perfect storm of an emotional breakdown in the sense of I'm exhausted, I'm tired, I have no place I can run and hide now in my own house because everybody's home. And so at the end of the day, women, we know this is true. We've seen an uptick, unfortunately and tragically, in suicide, in severe depression, people feeling isolated, feeling mentally like they are losing control, like they don't have control of their lives anymore. They're overwhelmed. And so this was a big byproduct, Jane, of everything that the other ladies have talked about, whether it was the economics, whether it was a career, whether it was trying to deal with schooling your children and finding a balance. All that stuff contributes to us feeling overwhelmed, stressed out, and exhausted. It goes back to what you opened with. You can have it all, but not at once. And women had to do it all at once during the pandemic.
At this point, I do want to switch gears a little bit and talk about something that's causing a lot of stress among a lot of women. And Cecile, you know full well that as someone who spent a lot of your life trying to protect women's reproductive rights, the Texas law, which is quickly being imitated by other states, which basically shuts down any kind of right to an abortion and gives the enforcement to ordinary citizens, is really rocking the country. What do you think the chances are that Roe will survive?
So I would say in the state of Texas, yes, Roe does not exist. The right to access for 90% of folks seeking an abortion, a safe and legal abortion, doesn't exist. I think it's about 7 million women of childbearing age in Texas can no longer access safe and legal abortion. And even Judge John Roberts, who I think, you know, has always been a questionable vote on the issue of Roe and the issue of safe and legal abortion, said that the whole law was crafted, you know, in this sort of bounty hunter scheme to insulate the state from implementing and enforcing an unconstitutional law. So that's disturbing in and of itself. But the other thing I think it's just so important to say, Jane, that is that abortion has not gone away in Texas. It simply has become illegal and unsafe. Before the Roe decision by the Supreme Court, nearly 50 years ago, young, healthy women were routinely dying in emergency rooms across the country from botched abortions, from illegal abortions and unsafe abortions. You can still talk to doctors who will tell you about doing rounds, and their stories are chilling. And so the cruelty of this bill is, of course, that women are now, particularly women with low incomes, women who we've already talked about, you know, disproportionately affected by so many of the things that we're lacking in the society, women who live in rural parts of Texas, women who work at a minimum wage job and can't get a week off or need to have someone to take care of their kids. These are the women who are really paying the price. And it is, it's horrifying to think that this is where we are in this country. And yes, I think it is a sign that Roe may be on the books, but it is unenforceable in the state of Texas right now.
We were fortunate, Stacy, to have the late evangelist Billy Graham's granddaughter, Jerusha DeFord, on a recent broadcast that we did. And she's a pro-life activist. And I'll repeat that. Jerusha DeFord is a pro-life activist. She surprised a lot of people when she defined what pro-life means to her. And I want to get your take on the other side. We have a clip of that right now.
I almost shriek a little bit when you say that I'm pro-life, because what that means to so many people versus what it means to me. What it means to me is, you know, from birth to the grave, in all different facets. I think what has happened so often is that we fight so much for the unborn, and then when they cease to be unborn, we turn our backs. I think we turn our backs on the mothers who choose life. I think that all of the policies that you just listed, I think statistics show us that if you can improve healthcare, if you can improve poverty, if you can improve all of those things, that the abortion rates actually go down.
So you understand, people were like, wow, she said that. How do you start to try and replicate that way of thinking? How that it's a mentality that just makes so much sense. These children are going to be born, and it's incumbent upon us to take care of them. You're smiling. What did you think when you heard Jerusha?
I'm laughing because I had this debate. I don't know why you came to me with this, but I did have this debate. My Republican colleagues just Friday, I mean, heated argument with them in both a Ways and Means budget reconciliation markup, and then in an Agriculture Committee markup. And the Agriculture Committee markup was related to school lunch programs. And my Republican colleagues not wanting to finance school lunch programs and support food stamps for families, when we know statistically that fraud is extremely low, less than 1% of the funding used in food stamps are fraudulently used, and that these are mostly working families that are receiving food stamps, veterans, elders, people with small children. And my discussion and my plea to my Republican colleagues were, support them after they're born. If you're pro-life, support the entire life of the individual. And we see that again and again, as you're discussing about the Texas law. This is going to disproportionately again affect poor women, affect women of color, Latino women, Black women, who are not going to be able to go across Texas lines to get the kind of services that they need, the decisions that they've made about their bodies and for their families with regard to having an abortion.
Gayne, could I chime in for a moment?
Sure, Sophia, go ahead, please.
I just wanted to kind of pick up on where the young lady you were talking to who is pro-life. I consider myself pro-life as well. And what that means to me, and as someone who was a lifelong Republican, now a never Trumper, I am concerned about a party and a movement that says we embrace freedom and we don't want to wear masks because you're impinging upon my freedom. But somehow a woman doesn't have the freedom of choice over her own body. Me, Sophia Nelson, the Christian, does not believe in abortion. Me, Sophia, that's my belief, my right. I'm not going to impose that on Congresswoman or on Cecile or on Caddy because they have freedom, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Each of us is entitled to that. So I'm not sure I understand when the right and the Christian movement, they merge themselves into this box where they will fight you to the death on not taking my gun because it's freedom and not wearing a mask and not taking a vaccine. But a woman doesn't have agency over her own body. That just doesn't work for me. Me personally, I'm opposed to abortion except race, incest, and life of the mother on religious grounds. But I would never deprive another woman of making a different choice than mine. And I just kind of wanted to throw that out there because I think there are a lot of people who feel like I do who aren't very vocal about it.
You're also psychic, Sophia, because I was just about to talk about the double standard in terms of wanting the freedom of not to get the vaccine. You're really on a roll here. So I'll go to Caddy, basically, because Jennifer Rubin at the Washington Post wrote a piece about the fact this is not about life at all, that these statutes are really designed to invade a woman's privacy, to make them uncomfortable. It's basically subjugation, that this is another form of controlling women. Do you see that at all?
Look, it's also economic subjugation, right? Of course, there are some people with very strong convictions. Sophia has just laid out the case who don't believe that abortion is something that they support in their own lives or would want to see. But this is largely an economic issue in the States because wealthy women in Texas are going to cross state lines and get an abortion or travel to where they need to travel in order to get an abortion. It's going to affect younger women, poorer women, women of color disproportionately, who don't have access to that ability to go and get an abortion where they want.
I also want to ask you, Caddy, about the juxtaposition of the Texas law with what happened in Mexico, was what the high court there basically paved the way for legalization of abortion rights. And they join, I think it's 31 countries that have expanded abortion rights, some of them as pious as Mexico. And yet three have rolled back abortion rights, and they are Nicaragua, Poland, and the United States. A women's rights researcher named Sophia Correa made the correlation, as many have, that if you're expanding women's rights, you're expanding democracy. So there's this whole piece of, in a way, this can be seen as anti-democracy. Or do you think that that's carrying it too far?
Look, I think certainly, you look at a country like Poland, which is rolling back democratic rights on a number of fronts, freedom of the press, right, independence of the judiciary, and on the issue of abortion, and you think that is a country that is going in an anti-democratic direction, and it is ironic to say the least, perhaps, that a state in the United States may be doing one of the things that Poland is doing. clearly it is tied up with, it's no coincidence that you're having this rollback of abortion rights in Texas and a rollback of voting rights in Texas. The two seem to be linked, and they're also linked in the sense that the more women who are voting, the less you're going to see of this, because we know that this is an issue that women tend to vote Democratic on and not Republican on. So there is the path is not totally clear yet, but I think most people would say there is a connection between expanding voting rights and expanding access to reproductive rights of women generally. And if you want to hold back women and you want to hold them back from voting, you do the kinds of things that Texas is trying to do, because, you know, it took, what, 6 decades for American women to vote in the same numbers as men. It was only in 1980 that they started voting in the same numbers as men. But boy, when they started, once they got there, they were far more engaged, and they were far more engaged on liberal issues like access to healthcare, access to childcare, environmental issues, and access to abortion rights.
Well, just on Texas, I just think, because I know this could be an entire program, but I do think it's important to recognize, really, to the points that Sophia and others made, you know, Texas is one of the states that refused to expand Medicaid access. There are so many ways in which we are keeping women and families down in that state. And to Kati's point, you know, I think it was September 1st, the day that the abortion ban in Texas went into effect, is the same day that Governor Abbott signed massive voting restrictions into effect. And it really was a very telling story about the state of the leadership of government, you know, political leadership in the state. This is a state where our problem has been that not that many people do vote, and now they're making it harder. To me, it's like what a totalitarian state looks like when the people in office are actually making laws against a majority of people in their state, and then taking away their very right to democratic participation to make a difference, or to elect people that may represent Texans better. And then the final point, I just can't help but point out, it is extraordinary to me as someone who was born in Waco, Texas, that women in Texas now may be crossing the border to Mexico in order to get a legal abortion that they cannot get in their own state.
Sophia, Linda Greenhouse from the New York Times wrote a piece with the headline, the provocative headline, "God Has No Place in the Supreme Court Decisions," basically was the gist of it. And between that and Mexico, what happened in Mexico in terms of legalization, we have a video question. We'd like to get your take on it first, on the other side, and let's all listen right now.
Hi, I'm Sophie from New York. So both Ireland and Mexico, two overwhelmingly Catholic countries, have legalized abortion recently. So why is it that the religious argument within the United States still carries so much weight?
Well, that's a great question. I'm not sure I have an answer other than to try to give you some context. One, I'm someone who was admitted to practice before the Supreme Court of the United States. So as of right now in the United States, abortion is still legal. Okay, that's a very important point to make. And federal law in the United States preempts state law, which is why I'm astounded, as is everybody on this panel and everybody watching, that the Supreme Court punted on this one. This Texas case clearly violates Roe versus Wade precedent and the law that has been the law. Casey certainly tried to erode Roe versus Wade by putting some exceptions, but abortion is legal in the United States of America right now. And states do not have the authority to override a constitutionally decided Supreme Court case that said this is now the law of the land. That would be like overturning Brown versus the Board of Education and saying that we're going back to Jim Crow segregation. Okay, I mean, they're very parallel. So I think that the answer to your question is there's a battle for the soul right now of the Republican Party, and the right, conservative right, is really winning that battle. And so you see the states where Texas, Mississippi, Alabama, where there are Republican governors, Georgia, they're going to try to enact these type of laws, and probably with great success, until the Supreme Court steps in and decides that it's either going to uphold the law of Roe or it's going to overturn it. That's the big question.
I want to ask quickly and then move on from this subject of reproductive rights. Stacey, President Biden has pledged a whole of government response to what's happening in terms of reproductive rights. The Justice Department has sued the state of Texas. How much hope do you have that any of that makes a difference?
I hope it does make a difference in terms of, a whole of government. I have concern over our new Justice Department that I think that they are not as aggressive as the law would allow them to be in supporting individuals. You know, listen, I think Sophia gave a prime example, right? Which was, how would it appear if a state attempted to turn over Brown versus Board of Education? But we do recall having a president that when Brown versus Board of Education became the law of the land, was willing to bring in federal officers to enforce it. Are we now going to bring federal officers to support a women's right to choose in Texas? That's a question that should be posed to this Justice Department. And what would be the fallout of doing that? That to me is a complete whole of government approach to protecting women's rights. And so I'm not sure what levers will be pulled that are within the framework of what the Justice Department is able to do and other agencies within the federal government that they'll do that. Will they withhold federal funding to those agencies within in Texas that attempt to keep a woman from receiving abortion rights? We'll see. But I think organizations like Planned Parenthood, other groups that are working, this is where we see intersectionality working the best on the ground, those grassroots organizations that are going to put tremendous pressure on lawmakers in Washington, right? We have not as yet codified a woman's right to choose in terms of passing congressional legislation. Those are the things that you may see coming out to support and to uphold the constitutionality of Roe versus Wade.
We're going to go back to the workplace at this point. And Cecile, I want to ask you, there are a lot of, on the wish list, a lot of things that have been factored into the human infrastructure bill, as it's called, and the child tax credit, which is very popular. And yet we're dealing with a Congress, as we all know, that has trouble getting things passed, basically. You may get it through the House and then it hits the Senate. So how concerned are you, you know, for these sweeping programs that could theoretically benefit women, that we're going to make some progress?
It is concerning because, of course, even though President Biden has been a supporter of all these things and the Democratic leadership has, we passed the American Recovery or Rescue Plan with zero Republican votes. And this is a completely partisan, divided Congress. And so all of the issues we're talking about, support for child care, for elder care. We still have a minimum wage of $7.25 an hour in this country and a sub-minimum wage for so many women who work in the tipped employee category. So there are so many things we need to do to not only rebuild our economy, but also to make sure that women can be part of the workforce. Unfortunately, with very few exceptions, these are exclusively being pushed for by Democratic leadership. I think it's going to be incumbent on all of us to continue to push for these issues and to make it clear who in office is supporting women's return to the workforce and who's getting in the way. And that's a big job.
Caddy, I'm going to get it right. Caddy. I've been calling you Caddy behind your back for all these years, and I apologize, but it's Caddy. You wrote a book.
Okay, I get everything. I don't mind.
Thank you. You're very sweet. You wrote a book called The Confidence Gap that basically talked about the fact that in the workplace, women lag way behind men when it comes to really feeling that they have a contribution to make, that they're sure of themselves. And now we have this pandemic comes rolling in. And I can't even begin to imagine how that's exacerbated the problem for so many women. Have you talked to women who have basically sort of, they feel they're backsliding instead of going forward because of what's happened with COVID?
Yeah, my co-author and I, Claire Shipman, are working on a new book actually on the subject of women and power and women's relationship with power and how women wield power, how the world would look different if more women wielded power. And we spoke to a lot of women during the pandemic in kind of, you know, full on lockdown time to try to get a sense of how they were feeling. I mean, I think what Sophia was talking about earlier, that incredible emotional toll of COVID and of having to do everything, of that feeling that you were failing somehow if you weren't keeping your family together, if you weren't keeping your job together, if you weren't keeping, you know, meals on the table, if you weren't juggling all of these balls and somehow you were letting some slip, it did, I think, produce something of a crisis of confidence in individual women. Women have suffered from a setback in sponsorship, a setback in mentorship, particularly women of color, have seen a decline in both of those important workplace tools during the pandemic, that it's been harder for women in the world of Zoom to get their ideas heard, to get their ideas leveraged, to get their own promotion and their own pay raises. Things that were already perhaps harder for women have become even harder. And that lack of sponsorship and mentorship is particularly concerning.
Katty, while I have you, I want to ask you and turn to the topic of domestic violence, which the United Nations says has spiked to unprecedented levels around the globe. It, of course, is a perfect storm where people are in quarantine, in lockdown, people are angry, people are in close proximity. It's just almost too awful to think about how many women have been trapped with abusers with either sexual or domestic violence. I mean, is anything possible in terms of trying to help women? You don't see anybody talking about that. They just report these horrible statistics. What's your take on that?
Yeah, I mean, you're right. And this has been, unfortunately, a global phenomenon, this spike in domestic violence. The European Union has just come out recently with a report on what they've seen as a crisis of domestic violence in the EU. And that's despite the fact that people were on furlough schemes. So the crisis of economic crisis within couples was not as acute in the EU. And yet we're still seeing that spike in domestic violence in European countries as well. It's not just the people who were being abused beforehand saw an increase in the abuse they were getting and couldn't literally physically get away because of lockdowns. What we've also seen is women who may not have been being in abusive relationships, suddenly they're partners, male partners, turned abusive because of the pressures of COVID, particularly if you've lost your job. I mean, for men losing their jobs in a world where, I mean, it gets a little bit back to what I was talking about earlier. We have to have a discussion about men and their value and their status and their options, because when they lose their jobs, you see this chronic reaction and it gets taken out on those closest to them. I think we need to have a conversation about men and boys and raising boys and how we can raise boys not to have the assumption that when you are under pressure and you've had your job taken away from you and therefore you feel emasculated, you take it out on women, but also a deeper conversation about why is it that men who lose their jobs suddenly feel emasculated? Can we change that dynamic where men have other things of life in their value of that are of equal value, their families, their kids, their whatever it is, their domestic lives, their friendships, in a way that they just don't at the moment, that they still don't have that range of options and support systems that women seem to.
Stacey, we're going to go to solutions next, but I have one more question for you, Stacey, and it's about something that happened to you before the 2016 primary that you had. And that is, without going into a lot of detail, you suffered what you called a cyber sexual assault. And basically, two of your aides hacked some private material from your phone and your computer. And the reason I'm asking you about this is because, having done some work with domestic violence victims myself, they blame themselves. Somehow, what did I do wrong? What could I have done differently? And again, we're talking about such large issues today that require years probably to change attitudes. But what would you say to a woman who's trapped in an abusive situation and somehow feels she's contributing to it?
Sure. Well, you know, thank you for even bringing this up. These were former aides who were not performing well and who I had counseled out of working with me and assisted them in, you know, looking for other employment. And yet we're not happy, you know, because I'm a woman, I was being too mean to them. And they were able to get information from me. But even more importantly, Jane, you know, I have been in, not in my present marriage, but I've been in situations where one feels that, you know, in an abusive relationship, particularly as a professional woman, you feel as if you are not allowed to say that, that you have to keep that under wraps because you have to project this image of being perfect, of being, you know, invincible, of not having fractures within your life. And so I would tell women who are in those kinds of relationships that you're not alone, that it's so much more common than you believe, and that there is a way out.
We're going to wrap this all up. It's a very tall order. But we're going to start with a video question that talks about a very complex issue, and as all these have been, but we'd like to get your thoughts on this, and let's watch it right now.
Hi, I'm Grace from Austin, Texas. My question is, gender equality and racial justice are tightly interwoven issues. Moving forward, how can we fight for women's rights through lens of intersectionality and end the gap not only between men and women, but more importantly, women of color and white women?
I'm going to go to Sophia because I know she's got an answer to this. So what would you tell Grace?
Well, if we're talking about the intersectionality piece, I think that that is really the great issue of our time as we go into further into this decade, into the next decade of the 21st century. White women and women of color are on an ascension. They're ascending in corporate America. They're ascending in the C-suite. They're ascending as doctors, as lawyers, as engineers, as members of Congress. Women of color still lagging behind, but certainly being more engaged. Our white sisters, once they get to those positions of power, they have to remember that women of color are still dealing with things that you as a white woman, you deal with the gender piece. You don't deal with the gender and the race piece. And that to me is something that if we can come together across political lines, across socioeconomic lines, et cetera, as women and walk by that woman code that I love to talk about, which is a code that is timeless. It's one that we learn from our grandmothers. It's one that we teach our daughters and our nieces. It's a code of conduct. We as women have to learn how to do that, I think, better and learn how to collaborate and work together to build the bridges and the things that we want for our daughters and our nieces and our granddaughters.
Jane, if I can just add one other piece to this. You know, this is not a partisan issue at all. And I even see it in the Democratic Party. You know, I'm a member of Congress, and looking at our Democratic leadership, we have not, since Shirley Chisholm, as a caucus, elected a Black woman to leadership. We allow Black women to support us and make sure that we get elected. We elect presidents. We swing states from red to blue, as in Georgia. But giving us the reins of power is something that still eludes us. When you look at who is in the C-suite of corporations and decision-makings, that decision-making even determines who's going to get the funding for so many important projects, for elections, right? Right now, we still are under a system in which members of Congress and those who are elected to leadership have to raise money. But disproportionately, that money does not go to Black women. We are there to do the work of getting people elected, but not to be those in leadership. And that has got to change. And it's not going to happen unless our white sisters demand it as well for us.
We have one more piece of tape, and it actually goes to code of conduct. It's really a statement from your colleague, Stacey, Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. Katty, I would like you to watch this piece of tape. And it came after the Congresswoman had been called out by one of her colleagues, Representative Ted Yoho from Florida. And she talks about how it affected her. So let's get your reaction to that on the other side.
But what I do have issue with is using women, our wives and daughters, as shields and excuses for poor behavior. Mr. Yoho mentioned that he has a wife and two daughters. I am 2 years younger than Mr. Yoho's youngest daughter. I am someone's daughter, too. My father, thankfully, is not alive to see how Mr. Yoho treated his daughter. My mother got to see Mr. Yoho's disrespect on the floor of this house towards me on television. And I am here because I have to show my parents that I am their daughter and that they did not raise me to accept abuse from men.
No, congratulations to the Congresswoman for calling out the behavior and for calling it out publicly and for reminding the Congressman of how badly he had behaved. I mean, unfortunately, women and particularly women of color are subjected to this all the time. It took a lot of courage, and you could hear the emotion in the Congresswoman's voice when she stood up there, because it is, as we were saying earlier, any kind of abuse is sort of embarrassing and you don't want to admit to vulnerability. I mean, we're sort of trained as women, and particularly women of color, never to be vulnerable. We've got this. We're not going to show a chink in our armor. We're going to be as tough as the guys. That has to change. The attitude has to change along with the behavior. It has to be okay to stand up there with emotion in your voice and say, don't treat me like this. I don't want my parents to have to see their daughter being treated in this way. None of us. I have a 26-year-old daughter. I don't want ever to think that she has to go through what I had to go through when I went into the workforce. And I kind of took for granted. I mean, I just thought, you know, the lecherous old guy who touched you up in the elevator or treated you badly at work, that was just sort of the price of entry to the workforce. And I think my generation, I'm 56, we just sort of thought, we had to accept it. It's so encouraging. When you talk about hope, it's great to see younger women, and it's hard for them, standing up and saying, we're not going to tolerate that anymore.
Hard to believe we are at the point for final questions, but I'm going to stick with Kati because you mentioned one of your daughters. I don't know the ages, but I know their names. Do you try to inculcate them with things that you've learned along the way that maybe are difficult to talk about?
Of course. And I think my own style of parenting has been impacted by all of the things that I have learned. I mean, I think I've become much more conscious of not encouraging our girls, and particularly our teen girls, to feel they have to be perfect, to feel that they have to be people pleasers, to feel that they can rock the boat and stand up. I mean, our research has shown us that between the ages of 9 and 13, girls lose a third of their confidence and they never get it back. And part of the reason they do that is they become terrified of failing. They want to please everybody. They want to be perfect. So we need to normalize failure for girls. I mean, boys are failing all the time and messing up in school all the time. And no one seems to mind. But girls are meant to be coloring the lines and put their heads down and, you know, obey all the rules. And I think we have to change that dynamic. We really have to catch our teen girls. And so all of the research that I have done has definitely made me more conscious of not being a perfectionist myself, because I'm my daughter's role model to some extent, and encouraging them to see failure as part of normal life and that it's okay to be vulnerable, it's okay to have chinks, it's okay to mess up. In fact, you know, that is what people do. It's annoying. It's an annoying part of being human, but it's what we do. And I think it has definitely changed the way I've parented to, and as a result, my teen daughter Poppy is very feisty and always answering back and prepared to say no and mess up and let it wash off her back. So I'm glad that she does.
I was going to say, next time you'll bring her with you. She sounds fabulous. Sophia, you were inspired by Shirley Chisholm, who's already been mentioned during this broadcast, who was the first African-American congresswoman, the first candidate to run as president for one of the major parties. There's somebody out there right now, Sophia, watching this show who feels they're at the end of the line, basically. They're dancing as fast as they can. They're frustrated by the pandemic. They've lost during the pandemic. You are such a proponent of somebody who believes in inspiration and aspiration and self-care. What would you say to the woman who just feels like there are no better days ahead for her?
Well, it goes back to what I said earlier. If we're honest, the word that describes most women, particularly working women right now, whether single, single moms, married, et cetera, is exhaustion. We're all tired. When you start to feel like you're at the end of your rope, when you start sinking into these depressive places and you're isolated, it means that you're not taking care of you. I'm not talking about just going to a spa day. Spas are great. I love them. I'm there all the time. What I'm talking about is really setting aside everyday time for you, with you, being the one that you need, making sure that before the kids get up, before the dog has to go out, that you sit down, put your aromatherapy candle on, get your Bible, get something that inspires you. Taking a few minutes for you to catch your breath, to get centered, changes the trajectory of your day. It's called commanding your day, commanding your morning. And so I want to encourage any woman who's feeling overwhelmed right now. Now, I know it's not that simple. You might have bills, finances, people being evicted. That's real. So please don't think I'm making light of it. But what I'm telling you is, girl, you can only change what you can change. And all change starts with you taking care of you and giving yourself a minute to breathe and to think clearly and to come up with a plan. Because one thing we know about us women, we are resilient and we can always find a way to stretch a dollar, to make it work, to take care of what needs to be taken care of, because we're women after all, and that makes us amazing. So hang in there. You're going to be okay.
Stacy, you are the daughter of immigrants. Your father was a police officer. Your mother worked in the court system. You, their daughter, has ascended through the ranks to be in the U.S. House of Representatives. You were an impeachment manager. You called out Mr. Trump's attorneys when they insisted on playing clip after clip after clip of Black women in negative stereotypes after the protests from last summer. You basically gave them what for. You have, I understand, a very feisty daughter named Talia, who's 12. And I've been told that you don't want to ever run against her. It sounds like she's already in that lane. Why don't you want to run against your daughter?
Well, thank you for that. And, you know, just to clarify, my parents are both from the island of St. Croix. So they migrated to New York, but were U.S. citizens prior to that, being from the Virgin Islands. And I've always said that, you know, I think that every generation should be better than the one before. And I'm hopeful that I have raised a daughter who is going to be better than me. She has the benefit of not just having a really supportive father and grandfathers, but four brothers who were really essential to me running in the first place. And they've already told me that if you're still in office and Talia's running, you know we're going with Talia. We're too afraid not to support her over you. But I want to raise a daughter who's better than me. And so if she's ready to run for office, I would assume that she's more qualified, going to be a better fighter and a better campaigner than I am. And I'd better stay out of her way if she was going to run against me.
And at this point, we have the final question going to Cecile, who also I know has an amazing daughter, possibly more than one, but your daughter, Lily, who is feisty and has moxie, and possibly because when she was a baby, she was in a backpack on a picket line with you and your husband, which sort of is what happened to you as a child with your legendary mother, Governor Ann Richards, and your father taking you out to be on a protest line. I guess my question to you is, there's so many things that can discourage us right now. We're living in a world that every day breaks our hearts in some new way. And my question to you is, if we're built for this fight, how do we really believe that we're built for this fight?
It's kind of a perfect question, I think, because I do think about my mom a lot, and she believed that so many times as women, we just sort of take ourselves out of the equation. I think this has been a bit of the thread, and I love being on with all these other incredible panelists and just their encouragement. But I think a lot of times as women, we think, whether it's running for office or trying for that C-suite job we've talked about or changing the world, that we don't have the right skills or we don't have the right education or we don't have the right contacts. And so I guess what I really think is important to just be communicating to young women in particular now is just start before you're ready. You know, don't worry about all your deficits. You know, men look in the mirror and think, oh man, I look like a congressman. It's time that we have as young women, you know, that we encourage young women to just get going. And I think to the thread that has also been through here, which I just can't support enough, is what I have found. I know there's a lot of conversation that women don't support other women, but what I actually feel like I have seen over these last few years is women taking joy in the success of other women in a way that, you know, it used to be there was only one woman, right, in everything. And now there are women everywhere. And so I feel like if we can encourage women who need that encouragement to start before they're ready, just jump in and go, and then we can all collectively take joy in their success. It's infectious. And I think that whether it's Shine Theory or whatever you want to call it, the more that women see other women breaking out and being successful, it reduces our sense of isolation. It reduces our sense of, I think, despair and feeling like things will never change. And it makes us hopeful about the future. And I'll just say, you know, spending this hour with the rest of you, it makes me hopeful too. So thanks for having me.
I don't even know what to say at this point, because this is definitely, Sophia, better than a visit to any spa. I just really, I'm sort of speechless, actually, but I do want to extend our heartfelt thanks to all of you for donating your time and your talent today, and for making us understand that we have the power to make days better in the future. Thanks for joining us today here in the other Washington, Washington, Connecticut. Until we see you back here next time for Common Ground, I'm Jane Whitney. Take care. I'm your host, Jane Whitney, with heartfelt thanks to you for joining us. Thanks as well to our distinguished guests for helping us to see a complex issue through a different lens, as our hope of finding common ground goes on. For more information on this podcast, or to watch the broadcast version of Common Ground, visit ctpublic.org/commonground.